ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय We're reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 4, Chapter 2, Prajapati Daksha curses Lord Shiva. This morning, text number 32. Tad Brahma Paramam Shuddham Suttam Vartma Sanatanam Vigarhya Yata Pashandam Daivam Vo Yatra Bhutarat Tad Brahma Paramam Shuddham Satam Vartma Sanatanam Vigarhya yata pashandam Daivam yo yatra bhutarat Tad brahma paramam shuddham Satam vartma sanatanam Vigarhya yata pashandam Daivam vo yatra bhutarat Tad brahma paramam shuddham Satam vartma sanatanam Vigarhya yata pashandam Daivam vo yatra bhutarat Oh, really? Well, you did very well. Huh? The technical problems, huh? Okay, so we'll just... I'll go ahead and do the... Tat, that, Brahma, Veda, Paramam, Supreme, Shuddham, pure, Suttam, of the saintly persons, Vartma, path, Sanatanam, eternal, Vigarhya, blaspheming. Yata should go. Pashandam to atheism. Daivam deity. Vaha your. Yatra where. Bhutarat the Lord of the Bhutas. Translation. This is Bhrigu Muni speaking. This is the conclusion of his cursing of the followers of Lord Shiva. It first started that Daksha, because Lord Shiva didn't stand up, a little offense, Lord Shiva didn't stand up. Daksha entered the assembly as sacrifice. Everybody stood up but Lord Brahma and Lord Shiva. Well, Brahma was his father, so that was okay. But Shiva was his son-in-law and should have stood up, according to Daksha. So, and he didn't like Shiva anyway, because he thought his daughter had married a hippie. And so he got insulted, and Daksha cursed Lord Shiva. Said you can't have any more share in sacrifices, and then Daksha left. And then Nandishwara, Shiva sat silently. He wasn't going to participate in this fiasco, this farce. He didn't say anything. So Nandishwara, of course, outraged. So he begins to curse Daksha and his followers, who are mostly vipras or brahmanas who are expert in the Karmakanda portion of the Vedas. So he does all that cursing. And then on behalf of the followers of the the Vedas, Bhrigu Muni then counter curses back again. And so this is the last statement that he makes. So he says, Bhrigu says, by blaspheming the principles of the Vedas, which are the pure and supreme path of the saintly person, certainly you followers of Bhutapati, Lord Shiva, will descend to the standard of atheism without a doubt. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Lord Shiva is described here as Bhutarat. The ghosts and those who are situated in the material mode of ignorance are called Bhutas. So Bhutarat refers to the leader of the creatures who are in the lowest standards of the material modes of nature. Another meaning of Bhuta is anyone who has taken birth or anything which is produced. So in that sense, Lord Shiva may be accepted as the father of this material world. Here, of course, Bhrigu Muni takes Lord Shiva as the leader of the lowest creatures. The characteristics of the lowest class of men have already been described. They do not bathe. They have long hairs on their heads, and they are addicted to intoxicants. In comparison with the path followed by the followers of Bhutarat, the Vedic system is certainly excellent, for it promotes people to spiritual life as the highest eternal principle of human civilization. If one decries or blasphemes the Vedic principles, then he falls to the standard of atheism. Tad Brahma Paramam Shuddham Satam Varitma Sanatanam Figarhya Yata Pashandam Daivam Vo Yatra Bhutarat. By blaspheming the principles of the Vedas, which are the pure and supreme path of the saintly person, certainly you followers of Bhutapati, Lord Shiva, will descend to the standard of atheism without a doubt. So this Prabhupada first talks about Lord Shiva being described as Bhutarat, the Lord of the Bhuta here means ghosts and hobgoblins and all those kind of nasty ghostly beings. He's because Lord Shiva's in charge of particularly, he's merciful to those in the lowest modes of nature. So the ghosts, Bhutas, Pretas, Pistulas, all those kinds of things. And also, Prabhupada describes ghostly human beings. This description of hippies again reoccurs. And he described hippies like that as ghostly people. In English, you have the same sort of interesting double use of a word like Bhuta. Bhuta here means ghost, but also can refer to any living being, any thing that is born. So the English word entity, which just means a being. I also saw there was some horror movie called The Entity. referring to thing like that is an entity. So you have the same sort of double meaning for a word like Bhuta. So it's not so unusual, I suppose. You know, just like you say to somebody, you thing. I thought I'd talk a little bit about this interesting position of Lord Shiva here. Somebody was asking about it, I guess, after class yesterday. His position... he's as the Lord of the modes of ignorance. So here you see in this particular passage, in this particular section, many other sections, Lord Shiva almost has this dual nature. He's a great saintly, he's a great, I mean, not saintly person, but a great saintly, pure being. He's the greatest of the Vaishnavas, Vaishnavanam Yata Shambhu, you know, the Ganges is the greatest of the rivers, and so on. So Lord Shiva is the greatest among the Vaishnavas. In fact, there's, of course, a Rudra Sampradaya. There's his own Sampradaya. He represents here principle of those who are actually transcendental to the modes of material nature. His own principles is he's completely beyond all social convention and rules and regulations of the Vedas because of his extremely elevated position. He lives in crematorium and dirty places, Daksha says, unfit place to live. But Prabhupada points out in the purport that so did Gaur Kishore Das Babaji. So sometimes the worst and the best, sometimes they look alike, you know. I think it was Jean-Paul Sartre pointed this out, that that saints and sinners are identical. The great criminals and saints are identical in this respect, that they both live outside the law. Of course, then he wanted to go on and say that a criminal is automatically a saint, which is something else entirely. Although there was that confusion in ISKCON for some period of time also. It's a fact. What was that confusion? Lord Shiva is so simultaneously a great transcendental personage and the master of many liberated souls, and similarly he takes charge of the lowest, worst of beings, because he's the lord of the modes of ignorance, the mode of ignorance and the people that are in them. And then also he's considered to be, as it says here, Bhutarat, the lord of the whole material world. And that is because that the material world is really produced out of false ego, ahankara, which is a form of ignorance, primordial ignorance. Ignorance of our real identity, that I am the body and I am the supreme, these sort of two divisions. And so therefore it's essentially forgetfulness of my spiritual nature and of my subordination to Krishna. So therefore this false ignorance is out of which the whole world is produced. So there's a sense in which everything, the whole world, is based on ignorance. And then the three modes are manifest, and then everything is created. There's either false ego in the mode of goodness, false ego in the mode of passion, and false ego in the mode of ignorance, and then everything else is produced. But the basic principle is false ego. And so this false ego is the person who's actually in charge of false ego is Lord Shankarshan, who is the Ishta Devata of Lord Shiva. As a great Vaishnava, the particular form of Krishna that Lord Shiva worships is Sankarshan. And Sankarshan is, of course, another form of Lord Sankarshan is Anantadev. And also, when Lord Sankarshan's described, he's also described as carrying a plow. So Baladev is also in this sort of cluster of Balarams, and then his expansion is Shankarshan, and then another expansion of Shankarshan is Anantadev. Now it says here, this is described in, first of all, in the third canto about Lord Shiva, that when the world is created, there appears in the he mentions here, okay, let me find it. In order to get release from the false ego, one has to worship Shankarshan. That's what he says here. Because Shankarshan is... you see, there's the Vasudeva, Shankarshan, Prajumna, and Aniruddha. This is the quadruple expansion. There's this these four personalities, and each of them takes charge or is the deity of a different aspect of the material world. Vasudev of clear consciousness, Shankarshan of the false ego, Aniruddha of the mind, and Prajumna of intelligence, I think. I'm sorry about that. I can't quite remember. Anyway, Prabhupada says, in order to get release from the false ego, one has to worship Shankarshan, because he's the ultimate lord of that element. Shankarshan is also worshipped through Lord Shiva. So he says that we can worship Shankarshan. Of course, we do directly, but he is also worshipped through Lord Shiva. The snakes which cover the body of Lord Shiva are representatives of Shankarshan. I want to talk about snakes today, the significance of snakes. One who is actually a worshipper of Lord Shiva as a devotee of Shankarshan can be released from false material ego. That's what he says. So this is when Lord Shiva is worshipped as a Vaishnava, as a devotee of Shankarshan. There's no problem. That's not demigod worship. You're not making the mistake of thinking that Lord Shiva is equal to or independent of the Lord. You're seeing him as he actually is. And then there's also mention about worshiping. Here's the other things. If one wants to get free from mental disturbance, one has to worship Aniruddha for this purpose. Worship of the moon planet is recommended in the Vedic literature. Similarly, to be fixed in one's intelligence, one has to worship Prajumna. Yeah, he's the lord of intelligence, who is reached through the worship of Brahma. These matters are explained in the Vedic literature. So that's what those snakes are. See, they represent Shankarshan. You may notice that Balaram is also associated with snakes. At least, if you see Lord Balaram when he's being bathed on Snanayatra without his hat on, his turban on, you see the back of his head coming up here is a big snake, right? So Balaram's also associated with snakes. And so is Lord Shankarshan. Now, where is Lord Shankarshan, or Ananta? At the bottom of the universe. Now, here's a very interesting picture that's given to us in the fifth canto. There's two heavens. Well, actually, there's three. But there's Divya Swarga, which is where Indra, Chandra, Surya, the gods live, right? And there's the Bila Svarga. Bila means a hole. The heavenly planets that are down in a hole. or the Prabhupada translate the subterranean. Subterranean means under the earth. Subterranean heavenly planets, where the asuras, or we would have to say the anti-gods, live. They're the gods, and they're the anti-gods. And they happen to be, for the most part, half-brothers. They're the same family. They're both sons of Kashyapa, one by Diti and the other by the demons are the children of Diti, therefore Daichas. So, and there's a third heaven is called Bhomaswarga, or heaven on earth. That's in one of the other varshas, where the demigods come down to play. So really you have these two. Svarga means wide open space. So there's the Svarga where the devatas live, who are the servants of Krishna, running the system as Krishna wants. And there's the other Svarga, which is the underground. The underground is really what it is. And it's also a place of enjoyment. This is not yet the hellish planets. That's down further, where Yamaraj punishes the sinner. Here, in the underground heavens, the counterculture, people are having fun, pretty much. But what is interesting is we find out that at the bottom of this underground is the Lord in the form of Anantadev or Shankarshan. So at the top there's a form of Lord Vishnu, and also at the bottom there's a form of Lord Vishnu. And so all of these are included together. And also in this canto, I think later on, I lost the place. It's in this canto. Lord Shiva is particularly a worshipper of Sankarshan because of being, as I said, the Lord of Tamogun. It's mentioned in the fifth canto when it's describing the various varshas. It describes Lord Shiva is situated in Ilavrita Varsha, encircled by 10 billion maidservants of the goddess Durga, who minister him. The quadruple expansion of the Supreme Lord is composed of Vasudeva, Prajumna, Aniruddha, and Shankarshana. Shankarshana, the forest expansion, is certainly transcendental, but because of his activities of destruction in the material world, are in the mode of ignorance, he is known as Tamasi, the Lord's form in the mode of ignorance. Lord Shiva knows that Shankarshana is the original cause of his own existence, and thus he always meditates upon him in trance by chanting the following mantra. The next verse is the mantra. Prabhupada says in the purport, sometimes we see a picture of Lord Shiva engaged in meditation. This verse explains that Lord Shiva is always meditating upon Lord Shankarshan in trance. Lord Shiva is in charge of the destruction of the material world. Lord Brahma creates the material world, Lord Vishnu maintains it, and Lord Shiva destroys it. Because destruction is in the mode of ignorance, Lord Shiva and his worshipable deity, Shankarshan, are technically called Tamasi. Lord Shiva is the incarnation of Tamoguna. Since both Lord Shiva and Shankarshan are always enlightened and situated in the transcendental position, they have nothing to do with the modes of material nature, goodness, passion, and ignorance. but because their activities involve them with the mode of ignorance, they are sometimes called tamasi. So you see that Shiva is sometimes talked about two different ways. Sometimes it's spoken almost as though he's in the mode of ignorance. Sometimes that he's transcendental to all the modes of nature. But here, I think, is a clear presentation that actually he's transcendental, but his activities involve him with the mode of ignorance. Not just Lord Shiva, but also Shankarshana. And so this destruction, of course, also it's Lord Shiva, but also Anantadev is the one who the fire from his mouths burn up the planets. I want this one. Anyway, when we get the description of the subterranean heavenly planets, this is where the demons live. And what's being done on each of these planets is described in detail. But they live very well because it's mentioned they're technologically advanced. There's one of the major, their acharya is Maya Danava. And he has a son, Bala. And both of them are very, very good at producing things for material welfare, including different kinds of mystic yoga, sorcery, and tricks. Maya Danava builds rocket ships, space vehicles, and things like that, cities, big cities. That's his specialty. He's a big engineer in technological development. It's dark. The way it's described is the sunlight doesn't reach there because it's the sun is only above the plane of Bhumandala, so it's dark. There's no passage of night or day, so the people have a sense of immortality, or they're not aware of the passage of time. You sort of imagine going down into a hole and then finding yourself in a vast cave, like a dark underground cavern. And at the bottom, there are snakes. This is sort of like what this is like. But these snakes give off light. This is what the light from down there is, all snake light. There are many-headed snakes. There's two planets that have many-headed snakes. And they, at the very bottom, Patala Loka, the last one, is where there are many snakes, but also there's another one that also have snakes, and they have jewels on their foreheads, and these jewels emit light, and so they that's where the light comes from down there. I was reminded of this once we had a Rath Yatra in Atlantic City, New Jersey, which is full of casinos, gambling casinos there. And to use a bathroom, I walked through one of these casinos. And there are no windows. The way the casinos work is no one should know what time it is. The people who are in there gambling are kept unaware of the passage of time. And it's lit up 24 hours a day. And any time of day you can order breakfast, or any time you can order lunch, any time you can order, it's completely... So when I saw this, this is to keep people gambling and just to forget that time is passing, that time is going on, puts them in another separate world where they can just engage in their sinful activities. And it reminded me of the, in many ways, those casinos reminded me of this, the subterranean heavenly planets in many ways. So on this planet, on the second one down, is actually Lord Shiva, Atala Vitala. And Vitala there's Lord Shiva, who also seems to be associated with gold, because he's the Lord of Gold, because he's engaged in sexual union with Bhavani, Durga, and it says the flowing of their procreative juices makes a river, and then when the mud gets soaked by this river and is ignited by fire, gold comes out, and so the people there are very rich because they manufacture this gold. So there is Lord Shiva, who's actually on one of these planets down there. But so is Bali Maharaj. He has his own planet. He's the good demon. So he's down there. Then we go on down various other descriptions how these people are enjoying life. And of course, they are definitely, I mean, they're called the demons. You know, the whole history of the universe, according to the Bhagavatam, tells us there is, in fact, interplanetary warfare been going on since the very beginning between the devatas, who are trying to run the universe on behalf of Krishna according to Vedic principles, and the demons, who are trying to take it over and run it according to their own methods. Usually they try to seize Indra's throne, but sometimes the more ambitious of them, well, the most ambitious I know of is Hiranyakashipu. And he wanted to... the demons think that the world has been created in an incompetent way, because there are things like old age and disease and death. And they think that if they seize control of the universe, they can live forever in material enjoyment. Which is basically, you can see that the whole tendency of the modern world is, in that sense, it's demonic. They really want to do the same thing. Scientists think that we're going to study the aging process. They think that in the cells, at a certain point, there's a kind of chemical switch that goes down, and then the cells begin to age, and that's the process of old age. And they're going to find out how that switch is, and figure out some way that they can go right in there and turn it back. Turn it back on again. You don't go rolled, you know. We can do this. As Prabhupada said, the demonic tendency is to want to live forever in this body and enjoy forever in this body. So they think that they can take over and fix it. So these inconveniences aren't there. But Hiranyakashipu actually wanted Brahma's position. The demigods warned him about this. Warned Brahma about this. He actually is worshiping you, and he wants your position, which is also demonic. You worship somebody, but your idea is when you get the chance, you kick him out and take his place. This happens enough in business life and things like that, or academics, or even in family life. It's time to retire, Dad. Now that you've taught me everything you know, out. So Hiranyakashipu was, he wanted Brahma's position, and it's described that what he wanted to do was reverse the effects of pious and impious activities. So that, in other words, when you follow the Vedas, you would suffer like hell, or in hell, literally. But when you performed your own sinful activities, you would prosper. You would be rewarded. That's how he wanted to fix the universe, so it would be better. Make the universe safe for demons, right? So that's the demonic tendency. So there's always this battle has been going on, this cosmic interplanetary warfare. I remember when the movie Star Wars came out in America, devotees started sneak off seeing it, and they said, they said it's about the Vedas. They had this intuition that there was something like that. What happened is the George Lucas, who wrote those movies, actually what he did was he studied old stories, what they call mythology, and most old stories come from the Vedas, and they tell this story of this cosmic battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. Early Jewish apocalyptic documents, the war of the sons of light against the sons of darkness. And so there's always been this notion of a dark gods or gods. Manichaean philosophy came from Persia, this the so-called dualism, and came into the West. In fact, this is the origin, they think, of the idea of Satan, the anti-God. And you may notice that satanic worship, when it occurred through history, seems to sound exactly like certain kinds of Shaivite worship. It's definitely religion in the mode of ignorance. Prabhupada mentions earlier the ritual use of sexual intercourse, taking of intoxicants, eating meat, doing their rituals in graveyards. These are all done by the tantric followers of Lord Shiva. And it's also a characteristic of Satan worship, who's always has very many features that we associate with Lord Shiva. The interesting thing is that Christianity disowns that aspect. I mean, I would have to say, if a student of religion, that Satan was a Christian god. That's exactly what we could call Satan, as a Christian god. But they don't call him a god, they call him the devil. But what is he but a god? But they have the notion that somehow or other, he's not under the control of God. He somehow broke loose and is independent. Although whenever you see Christian theologians try to think of Satan, they start to, when they think it through, they start to say, well, some way he's actually serving God, like that. But the real story is, that element of darkness or ignorance is also actually integrated into Krishna's plan. So the universe is described, the history of the universe is described, that in the beginning there's Lord Brahma and the Prajapatis. In the middle there's Lord Vishnu and the saintly kings. And in the end there's Lord Shiva and the atheists full of anger. So this is really an integrated plan. It's not like there's some kind of accident like that. The description of the subterranean heavenly planets, where the demons live and do their little work and try to take over. Earth is in the middle. This is like battleground Earth or something, where the middle territory, right on the border, the no man's land, where they're trying to fight for possession of Earth. This seems to be going on. So at the bottom, you go down, it describes, and you get down to Patala, the last planet where the snakes are. By the way, the snakes are well known throughout the world. Outside of Vedic culture, they're usually called dragons. These are the same thing, I'm convinced, the celestial snakes. And the snakes are associated, again, with the devil, for example, in the Christian story, that the serpent appeared in the Garden of Eden and so on, like that. But in some parts of the world, the snakes are, in some places, some cultures, snakes are viewed as evil and bad. So, particularly in the West, like Christianity, the Saint George is killing the dragons, and you know, so there's a great deal of anti dragon stories. The dragons are always the bad guys. It would seem that if you take this as a serious history, there was a time where these Nagas would come up and at least be visible to people. Maybe they now come and you can't see, because they possess all kinds of powers from Bala and Mayadhanava. So they change shapes, they become invisible, they turn themselves into rock stars or whatever. Political leaders, who knows, you know. But in other parts of the world, the dragons are regarded as auspicious, like in China. Dragons are very auspicious. And there's a story relating a Buddhist story, which says that in the beginning, you know, later on in Buddhism, there was, after some period of time, a Buddhism developed in a new way in what's called Mahayana Buddhism. And when Mahayana Buddhism developed, that's the form of Buddhism that spread all over the world. Originally, what was called was Hinayana. And it was strictly for monks. It was extremely austere. Hardly anybody could do it. It was tough. But then there was a kind of new scriptures appeared, and suddenly Buddhism was in a form that householders could practice it, and the regulative principles weren't so strict, and that's the form in which it spread all over the world, called the Mahayana, or the greater vehicle. It means it includes more people. So when this Mahayana Buddhism showed up, there were scriptures that people hadn't seen before. And so the story was that Buddha had originally spoken these scriptures, but they weren't going to be revealed until the ripeness of the time. The scriptures were spoken, and they were hidden away with the Nagas. They were kept and preserved by the Nagas. And then the right time, the Nagas let them loose. So a scholar who mentioned this story noted that Buddhism spread very easily in those countries in which Nagas are revered and worshipped. But in those countries in which Nagas are regarded as evil or demonic, dragons and like that, Buddhism never fared very well. This is kinds of interesting. There's an association, of course, between when they mention the Pashandis, and this curse against Shiva. Both Prabhupada has mentioned Buddhism and Mayavad philosophy, which is really a kind of rewrite of Buddhism. It's covered Buddhism, it's called. It is atheistic. So this and this Mayavad philosophy is one of the activities of Lord Shiva. That's also described. He does it in order to help increase Kali Yuga. That's one of the things that it does. Because when transcendence is described in negative terms, the material world starts to look more and more attractive to people. And so one of the functions of this Mayavad philosophy is actually to help spread ignorance. This is all done at the command of the Lord. Anyway, I just want to here is, after describing the subterranean heavenly planets, there's a description of Anantadev. And Sukadev Goswami says, 240 miles beneath the planet Patala, lives another incarnation of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is at the root. It's described as the root of Patala. He's the expansion of Lord Vishnu, Lord as known as Lord Ananta, or Lord Shankarshan. He is always in the transcendental position, but because he is worshipped by Lord Shiva, the deity of Tamagun or darkness, he is sometimes called Tamasi. Lord Ananta is the predominating deity of the material mode of ignorance, as well as the false egos of all conditioned souls. So again, that's his position, these two things. When a conditioned living being thinks, I am the enjoyer and this world is meant to be enjoyed by me, this conception of life is dictated to him by Shankarshan. Thus, the mundane conditioned soul thinks himself the Supreme Lord. This great universe situated on one of Lord Anantadev's thousands of hood appears just like a white mustard seed. It is infinitesimal compared to the hoods of Lord Ananta. At the time of devastation, when Lord Anantadev desires to destroy the entire creation, he becomes slightly angry. Then from between his two eyebrows appears three-eyed Rudra. That's Lord Shiva, a form of Lord Shiva. Rudra means one who howls or screams. Between his two eyebrows appears the three-eyed Rudra carrying a trident. This Rudra, who is known as Sankarsana, with a long A, not Sankarsana, but Sankarsana, which means the derived from or son of Sankarsana. This Rudra, who is known as Sankarsana, is the embodiment of the 11 Rudras or incarnations of Lord Shiva. He appears in order to devastate the entire creation. And Prabhupada says, in each creation, the living entities are given a chance to close their business. And do not go back home, back to Godhead, Lord Shankarshan becomes angry. That's specifically what makes him angry. The 11 Rudras, expansions of Lord Shiva, come out of Lord Shankarshan's eyebrows due to his angry mood, and all of them all together devastate the entire creation. So then it describes further of Lord Shankarshan. The pink transparent toenails on the Lord's lotus feet are exactly like valuable gems polished to a mirror finish. When the unalloyed devotees and the leaders of the snakes offer their obeisances to Lord Shankarshan with great devotion, they become very joyful upon seeing their own beautiful faces reflected in his toenails. Their cheeks are decorated with glittering earrings, and the beauty of their faces is extremely pleasing to see. So now he's being worshipped by the leaders of the snakes, great devotees and I don't know whether there's an overlap or not, the best of the devotees and the leaders of the snakes, both of them with unalloyed devotion. So this is really interesting what's happening down there. Then it goes on. Lord Ananta's arms are attractively long, beautifully decorated with bangles, and completely spiritual. They are white, and so they appear like silver columns. When the beautiful princes of the serpent kings, it means the unmarried daughters of the serpent kings, the Naga Raja Kumariyaha, yeah, the unmarried Kumaris, When the beautiful princesses of the serpent kings, hoping for the Lord's auspicious blessing, smear his arms with aguru pulp, sandalwood pulp, and kumkum. The touch of his limbs awakens lusty desires within them. Understanding their minds, the Lord looks at the princesses with a merciful smile, and they become bashful, realizing that he knows their desires. Then they smile beautifully and look upon the Lord with lotus face, the Lord's lotus face, which is beautified by reddish eyes, rolling slightly from intoxication and delighted by love for his devotees. In the purport, Prabhupada talks about spiritual bodies. When male and females touch each other's bodies, their lusty desires naturally awaken. It appears from this verse that there are similar sensations in spiritual bodies. Both Lord Ananta and the women giving him pleasure had spiritual bodies. So this makes it very interesting what's going on. 240,000 miles below Patala. There apparently is Anantadev and the daughters of the serpent kings in spiritual bodies. Lord Shankarshan is the ocean of unlimited spiritual qualities, and thus he is known as Anantadev. He is none different from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. For the welfare of all living entities within this material world, he resides in his abode, restraining his anger and intolerance. The demigods, the demons, the Uragas, the serpentine demigods, the Siddhas, the Gandharvas, the Vidyadharas, and many highly elevated sages constantly offer prayers to the Lord. Because he is intoxicated, this Balaram-like feature, the Lord looks bewildered, and his eyes, appearing like flowers in full bloom, move to and fro. He pleases his personal associates, the heads of the demigods, with the sweet vibrations emanating from his mouth. Dressed in bluish garments and wearing a single earring, he holds a plow on his back. And with his two beautiful and well-constructed hands, appearing as white as the heavenly King Indra, he wears a golden belt around his waist and a Vajayanti garland of ever-fresh tulsi blossoms around his neck. Bees, intoxicated by the honey-like fragrance of the tulsi flowers, hum very sweetly around the garland, which thus becomes more and more beautiful. In this way, the Lord enjoys his very magnanimous pastimes. And then Prabhupada goes out to let me read the next verse, might as well. If persons who are very serious about being liberated from material life hear the glories of Lord Anantadev from the mouth of a spiritual master in the chain of disciplic succession, and if they always meditate upon Sankarshan, the Lord enters the cores of their hearts, vanquishes all dirty contamination of the material modes of nature, cuts to pieces the hard knot within the heart, which has been tied tightly since time immemorial by the desire to dominate material nature through fruitive activities. Narada Muni, the son of Lord Brahma, always glorifies Anantadev in his father's assembly. There he sings blissful verses of his own composition, accompanied by his stringed instrument or a celestial singer, that's how you read it, known as Tumburu. And so Prabhupada emphasizes that these descriptions of Lord Anantadev are not imaginary, but are quite to be taken as quite factual. And then later on he quotes verses from Chaitanya Bhagavat in glory of Lord Anantadev. So it is just interesting to see, in conclusion, all this. We start off with Lord Shiva and his kind of dual aspect that he has. And we trace him down to the subterranean heavenly planets where all the demons are. And you notice the demons mostly worship Lord Shiva. They tend to be impersonalists and Shaivites, like what's his name? whom Ramchandra killed, and yeah, Ravana was worshipping Lord Shiva. So many demons are worshippers of Shiva, and so we see. But Lord Shiva turns out to be not really bad, and a worshipper of Lord Anantadev, who's associated with the snakes and the Nagas and so on, who turns out to be, of course, the Shankarshan and the incarnation of Krishna. So we have here a very ultimately integrated picture of the world, everything else, in Srimad Bhagavatam. Just thought that was interesting. What's really going on here? Any questions or comments? Yeah.
And the two forms of Anantadev, because one description is where the universe is unshared by a master seed.
Mm-hmm.
And the other description is he's inside and
within. Yeah, isn't it interesting? Uh-huh. Yeah. It would seem he appears in different features. Sometimes it's the planets are on his head, but here it is really described. The universes are on his head, so he's almost outside the universes. Yeah, I noticed that. Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah, Shankarshan. It's described as, you notice how they go back and forth. Like sometimes he's like in the form of a many-headed snake, and sometimes he's with a plow on his shoulder and Shankarshan, because they're expansions, and he just... It's the same Lord and just in these different forms according to what he's doing. When you worship Ananta, you can worship him either in his serpentine form or in his human form. He's the same Lord. Yeah, same one. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. He shows up a number of places. And who's ultimately Lord Balaram, who has the plow and who has the snake over his head. Oh, Balaram is also associated with this underground, earthly sort of position. It's like Lord Vishnu is the sky and Lord Balaram is the earth, if you like those dualities there. Everything is included. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he has that tendency, doesn't he? You're right. He is a little, he was favorable toward them also. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. His name, Duryodhana Guru is one of his names. Uh-huh. Yeah, that's true. He was partial toward them. Mm-hmm. So, this is a picture of what's going on. It's a little interesting that seeing Christianity, this kind of dark or black side of things is just completely disowned, and try to separate it as though they're two gods who have nothing to do with each other. But that's not that's actually here we see that even the Lord is taking care of demonic people, and like Lord Shiva, he gradually brings them back. There's an attempt to redeem them and bring them back into the progressive path of self-realization somehow or another.
This integration here between the light and the dark, could you say that now we're discussing the history of the dark ages of this time?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was dealing with them, reporters would ask me, what happened with Kirtananda, you know? Why, wasn't he one of your leaders and everything? And finally I said to some reporters, I said, he surrendered to the dark side of the force. Which is from Star Wars, you know? Oh, okay, now they understood.
The dark side of the force.
Force. The dark side. They said Darth Vader. You know, he was a Jedi Knight, and then something. He became evil, And that's what it's, I think it's in the line in the movie that he went over or surrendered to the dark side of the force. So, that's what I told the reporters.
Uh-huh.
Immediately. Of course, when it was in the newspapers, you know, some of Kirtananda's followers got quite angry that I was comparing Kirtananda to Darth Vader. But anyway, that's another story. Yes? Well, Prabhupada says it here many times. They have unkempt hair. The actual Prabhupada says long hair, but I think if you look at the actual Sanskrit where it's mentioned in Kali Yuga, it means that the hair is not taken care of. Not exactly that it's long, but that it's wild, it's unkempt. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. But particularly the Shaivites, they don't cut their hair. And so it grows long. It becomes like Rastafarians, dreadlocks. You know, they call it, comes and it mats up and gets all matted and everything and birds nest in it and things like that. So that's what it's talking about, but it's very certain when these people are described, what Prabhupada had in mind was the hippies, you know, that he encountered, were just like, they were definitely in the mode of ignorance, didn't bathe, took marijuana, had their hair long, and untaken care of. I mean, you know what a job it is to take care of long hair. It's really time-consuming. And they didn't go to that process of washing it or anything like that. So that's what he said here. Yeah, otherwise, Krishna seems to have long hair and so on, at least relatively long. But other people, they never, ever cut the hair. Never. And from that, accordingly, you know, like that Bhishikasena that was attacking Bhaktivinoda Thakur, it's like the story of Samson, you know, in his uncut hair was resided his mystic power, and when he finally was cut off, all his potency went away. The story in the Bible, Delilah cuts his hair, and his strength left. So it seems like there was some process that long hair was associated with some kind of powers, supernatural, mystical potency. You know, anything else? Śrīla Prabhupāda ki jai.